You know when your customers are shopping at your business and they pick up a product? The customer holds it, feels it, and shows it to their friend. Then they look at the price tag.
Oh my, I need to look at something else.
The customer picks up a second item and loves the way it looks. They've heard of this product, but haven't yet seen it in person.
I've got to have this!
You're happy the customer chose to buy a product, but you're equally frustrated that they didn't buy both items.
I want them both.
The Consumer Experience Lab at Barbera Solutions designs behavioral strategies that target the consumer's decision-making process. BarberaSolutions.com. Because the opposite of rational is not irrational. B-A-R-B-E-R-A Solutions.com. Why is the shopping cart always in the top right of the screen?
How do companies predict my purchases?
Why do prices end in 9?
Why do fast food companies use red and yellow in their logos?
Why do restaurants always have one expensive menu item?
Researchers, marketers, and very curious people seek the answers for how we make decisions and how we choose products. ClickSuasion finds the secrets that companies use and shares them with you.
Why do I feel better when I bought the last remaining airline ticket?
How do I make choices based on colors and fonts?
Welcome to ClickSuasion. This is Michael Barbera. Today we're with Suzanne Altobello. Suzanne recently returned from teaching a course in Finland. She's back here in the United States. So Suzanne is the Associate Professor of Marketing at the University of North Carolina, Pembroke, where she teaches principles of marketing, marketing research, sales management, integrated marketing communications, and digital marketing and social media analytics. Suzanne's research interests are in the areas of consumer behavior, digital marketing, social media, technology acceptance, international pricing, small business strategy, and services marketing. Suzanne's work has been published in top academic journals such as the Journal of Consumer Research, Journal of Business Research, Psychology and Marketing, Journal of Services Marketing, and Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin. Suzanne, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Michael.
Well, so tell us about Finland. What did you do there, and how was your trip?
So my trip was amazing. I had never been to Finland before, but I had taken students abroad for 14 years when I was a professor at Southern Illinois University, and I would often take them to the Grenoble Graduate School of Business in Grenoble, France, which is a triple accredited business school. So I was familiar with the structure of a triple accredited AACSB included business school. And the way that I got involved with teaching in Finland was actually based on the desire for a sweatshirt, of all things. So a friend of mine who's a professor at the university taught at this school in Finland last year. And he was posting on his social media and always checking in at a school named Aalto University. So A-A-L-T-O University. And honestly, I just wanted a sweatshirt because my students call me Dr. A or Dr. Aalto, because Altobello is sometimes a mouthful to say. And so I said, hey, let me get me a sweatshirt. And he said, I'll do one better. Why don't you teach here? You'd be great. And put me in touch with the director. And we really hit it off. And her philosophy of business education really fit with mine. And so I went out there for a three-week module in May of this year, and taught till June, and had an amazing time learning about how they run their business education bachelor's program, as well as the other master's programs in design and entrepreneurship, and their MBA program. So Aalto University was formed in 2010 as a rebrand of their Helsinki School of Economics, School of Design, School of Arts and Sciences, and all of that was put together under the Aalto brand in honor of Alvar Aalto, who's a famous designer in Finland. And so I taught in the bachelor's program, the Bachelor's of Business Administration program, which is about 2.5 hours north of Helsinki in a town called Mikkeli. And it was great. I had a very skilled students. They spoke amazing English, wrote very well. It turns out that in the 60s, the Finnish government made a decision that they would not dub English language television or movies. And so instead, they have the Finnish and Swedish subtitles at the bottom of the television screen. So as a result, children in Finland start learning English as early as, you know, first, second, and third grade in school, but they're also being exposed to all of our media before then. So really excellent speakers, good writers, obviously multilingual, not only Finnish, but most of them also speak Swedish. And it was just fascinating. In addition to that, I had 15 students from Vietnam because Finland had a very open tuition platform. So if you got into the school, you went for free, no matter where you came from. Of course, that actually will change this year. So non-EU students will have to pay tuition, but it's still less than what you'd pay here in the United States. And then EU students do go to Aalto for free if they have the grades to get in. So just really interesting pedagogy and excellent professors. It was really an exciting time for me. And I got to eat lots of different foods that I've never tried before.
Isn't that the reason why we travel?
To eat different foods?
Absolutely.
Yes, possibly. I had a colleague there who was basically just not as adventurous as I am. So every time we went somewhere, she would just say, well, she'll have the most craziest thing on your menu, and I'll have a steak. So, but I really enjoyed it. I had reindeer and moose and elk, which was delicious, and wild boar and bear meat and lots of different fishes. And I ate the fishes whole and in rye bread as a pie. So just really fascinating. It was great.
So what you're saying is that you had all the meats.
All the meats, yes. It was a high protein diet while I was there.
So from my understanding, the program that you taught at is primarily taught in Finnish. So why would a student decide or choose to take a course in English when the majority of their program is dominated in another language?
Well, in this particular school, it's actually one of only 2% of all undergraduate programs in Finland that are offered completely in English. So this particular 2.5-year bachelor's in business administration, because it is AACSB accredited, is offered completely in English. So it made it very easy for me to go in and teach. They're using the same textbooks that we're using here. You know, the students are well prepared for learning in English and submitting work in English. But you're right, the majority of bachelor's programs in Finland are offered in Finnish. So this is a unique, really unique and high level school. So this would be, you know, considered the Ivy Leagues in Finland.
Tell us about some of your gamification or Internet of Things research.
Wow. So there's so many different things that I'm working on right now. I've always been interested in gamification, and primarily that is because I'm curious why people do things. And the example I give all the time that I gave on the first episode of the Clicksuasion podcast is, you know, why would people walk around their beds at night? Because they're at 9,963 steps and they need to 10,000 in order to get that badge, or the challenges that people have, and that, you know, that they challenge each other, and whoever wins gets the, you know, challenge badge, and sort of the bragging rights. And I'm really fascinated by that because from a business perspective, you know, that's really identifying consumers who are extremely motivated to behave a particular way for no economic gain. It is simply a, what I call in my research, a social reward. So that badge is something that is socially posted. That could be a badge on someone's LinkedIn profile for doing additional professional certifications. It can be a badge on their, you know, Fitbit profile. It can be a little picture badge on their Amazon account to show that they are, you know, a, you know, valued reviewer. It could be on Yelp for reaching a particular number of reviews. And so those social badges are quite interesting because if a company can identify which types of their consumers are motivated by those digital badges, these are your brand evangelists in many ways. And so finding out what a consumer is, how they're motivated and how you can motivate them to engage in behavior that doesn't cost the company a single dime is strategically really important. And so, so my research in gamification kind of follows a lot of that, trying to identify key behavioral personality traits and situations that we can put people in that that examine their motivations, both economic rewards versus social rewards in engaging with the brand. So so that's kind of the gamification research that I've been doing. And we're applying that in different contexts. So certainly in the brand context that I'm talking about here, but we're also looking at it in terms of adult learning. So we'll offering badges in an online course not only produce faster progression through the course, but also improved academic outcomes in the course due to that the offering of badges. And then we're also looking at even political activity among millennials and whether or not we can engage people in the political process by offering these kind of gamification types of incentives to be more of a responsible citizen. And so those are the different applications of this.
Besides being a more responsible person or identifying who the loyal customers are or who is the fully connected customer, what are some of the benefits for an organization, regardless of organization type, to design a campaign that uses gamification or social rewards?
So we can look at this from two perspectives. One is inside the organization. So in a consulting realm, I'm working with a company that is looking at how to gamify and offer sort of incentives and badges and levels of progression through a basically a multi-level marketing network type of scenario. And so if you look at this from within your organization, so within your employees, offering this type of gamification strategies can engage your employees. And that can lead to more satisfaction with their job, more engagement with their job, less turnover, higher KPIs or performance indicators. And so there are a lot of consequences of engaging your employees. On the other side of the coin, we can look at using gamification in order to engage more with your customers. And so, you know, the gamification principles, addiction principles, things like that really can affect customer loyalty. A lot of consumer behavior research has shown that customers that are more brand loyal are also less price sensitive. So therefore, they are less affected by slight price increases because they're so loyal to your brand. We also see from a business perspective that these engaged customers are also your brand loyalists. So they speak on behalf of your brand on social media. They defend your brand. They promote your brand at much higher rates. So there are a lot of financial considerations both within the organization and employees and outside the organization with your target consumers that really make gamification principles extremely important right now in today's competitive virtual environment.
What are your thoughts on the perception of gamification or social rewards when an individual is to use them via a mobile device or on a desktop?
Well, we know that by 2020, 80% of all internet searches will be done on a mobile device. So from that perspective, a company can no longer ignore mobile. And when I say a company, I even mean, the work I'm doing with some physicians here in North Carolina, have really opened their eyes to the fact that even their existing customers, even their existing patients, are usually calling them and getting that phone number from a Google search or from a Safari search on their iPhones or from a Bing search on their, you know, Samsung phones or whatever. But the reality is that even service firms need to make sure that their mobile sites are active, their locations are chosen, their website is mobile enabled, or what we call mobile responsive, meaning that it is responsive to any type of device that you would visit their website on. And so it really is no longer a preference, but really a necessity for companies to make sure that their digital presence is effective and persuasive.
Now, I thought I travel a lot, but I think you might have more airline miles than I do, and that's quite impressive. So during your travel and your experience and research abroad, how do you feel gamification and incentives might change by culture?
So one of the biggest things that I've noticed in my travels has been really the difference between a walking public transportation culture and a driving private transportation culture that we have here in the United States. So I remember one time I was teaching in Europe and I was in the Netherlands and I was on a canal cruise. And right in the middle of the canal cruise on the wall was a QR code. No information, no brand, no URL, just a QR code painted on the side of a canal. And I was fascinated. So of course I had to take out my phone and take a picture of this QR code. And and so when you talk about curiosity, and I know that I've mentioned this before, but really my whole career has been driven by curiosity of why consumers do particular things. And that moment in, I think it was 2009, 2008 even, on that canal cruise in Amsterdam, I was that curious consumer. What's that QR code all about? You know, I wanted to know what brand was, advertising and what they were promoting and stuff like that. And so when you have a walking culture, in more of a city type public transportation, think about all of the times that you're on, a train in Chicago or a metro or subway in New York City. You do have downtime. You are a captive audience. And so those are the times that I do see a lot more creative types of promotional outdoor campaigns that I think are very engaging, and that type of gamification. The idea of gamification is kind of like I always equate it to a scavenger hunt. It's that desire to get to the next level or the next badge or the next location, and that impetus, that drive, that motive for action is what companies want. They want to be creating that, right? And so you really can't, if I look at some of my favorite, even viral campaigns in the last few years, they do have a gamification principle. Whether they call it that or not, they are engaging the customers in this, not just a two-way dialogue, but a two-way behavior. And getting them to do something, to move, and I just find that really fascinating. I mean, last summer's Pokemon Go phenomenon, a video I show all the time in my marketing classes is a Nike campaign called Catch the Flash, where they have people running, nighttime runners that are running with reflective jackets on, and people had to take pictures of them running and basically collect these pictures in sort of a gamification type of design. So when you get customers to be truly behaviorally engaged with your brand, and often that means physical engagement, or like some of the stuff I'm doing right now, virtual engagement, but getting them involved and engaged in behavior is really the sort of ultimate type of goal that you would have to really engage with the brand. And so I find that fascinating. And so any companies that come with to me and say we want to, we want to incorporate these gamification principles into our brand or into our company. You know, it really is a combination of analytics even. So, for example, I'm working with a company in Chicago that that does consulting, and they offer multiple sort of workshops for a company for other companies. So they're a business-to-business consulting firm. And I said to them, have you ever actually looked at, you know, creating a metric for, you know, for however many workshops an employee has been to, it results in, you know, X percent more in their sales, or it results in less turnover for the company, or these other types of, you know, faster path to management, and those kinds of things. And a lot of companies don't really make that connection between these sort of, you know, regression or predictive analytic techniques and gamification and outcomes. So that's what I kind of like to do, is really put a value on these types of initiatives for a company.
So how could organizations use their current data to design incentives or social rewards or any kind of gamification campaign?
Well, one is that they have to really understand, you know, their target. So if it's employees, for example, they have to understand what motivates their employees. So is it some sort of economic reward? Like if you wear this Fitbit and you reach an average of 8,000 steps a day or 10,000 steps a day for a month, you get a reduction in the cost of your insurance, for example. That's one economic type of reward versus a social reward, saying, you know, at the end of the month, whoever's walked the most average daily steps gets a, you know, gets the right to have this badge or wear a hat or have this, you know, really silly trophy that they get in their office and is sort of kind of publicly congratulated by the management for this reaching this goal. So it's really a social reward. You're getting socially patted on the back or identified with reaching a particular goal. And we see that a lot in sales organizations, right? So if you reach a particular threshold, you know, you get there. So some companies that are in more of metrics, performance, anyway, they understand these gamification principles. So the first step is really understanding what motivates people, not just your employees, but also your consumers. And so once you understand what motivates them, then it is in the design of the game, technically, and the rewards within the game that that is really important. So the first step would be maybe you know, some research, some short surveys that examine, you know, what motivates people. And then it's combining that information with a program that really puts those principles into play. And then the third step is tying that back to key performance indicators within the organization, if you're talking about employees, or consumer KPIs like sales or how much time they spent on your website or how much they engage with you on social media or how often they share your content or if they are given a coupon code, how much they share that and, you know, kind of how they basically promote your brand in other types of performance indicators that we might track on a Google Analytics or, you know, in a data analytics format. So, and then the fourth step is, of course, putting that together in some sort of predictive model so that a company knows for their particular product or service with their particular target audience, you know, these are the gamification principles that are most effective.
So we're here with Suzanne Attabella. We've been discussing social rewards and gamification. We're going to segue into virtual commerce. Real quick, let's take a quick break and we need to pay some bills.
You always want to look your best, but you don't always have time to deal with a necktie that won't cooperate. That's where we come in. Introducing the Nevertie, the only necktie that you never have to tie. Each Nevertie comes with a tie and two removable knots that you simply slide on and adjust for your comfort, giving you the perfect look every time. Choose from over 20 stylish designs at thenevertie.com.
Welcome back to ClickSuasion. This is Michael Barbera. Thanks for listening. Today's guest, Suzanne Attabella. We've been discussing social rewards, incentives, and gamification. Now we're going to discuss virtual commerce, which is it's popular, but not, say, well-known to every person. So, Suzanne, tell us a little more, or tell us everything about virtual commerce.
Well, I'm sure I can't tell you everything about virtual commerce, but what I can tell you is that it really is the future of understanding how to engage physically with your customers. And so actually Forbes has done some really interesting work in last year on highlighting virtual commerce, in particular, you know, with clothing brands, for example, and eyeglass brands, and things that customers feel like they need to touch or experience physically in order to purchase. And how can we replicate that using digital technology. So whether we're talking about, you know, wearing, you know, Google goggles and or virtual reality headset, putting your phone inside that headset, and then allowing people to create an avatar based on their measurements that then allow them to physically try on clothing products, shoes, eyeglass frames, haircuts, all of those things that we do, you know, in real life, I guess, and how can we replicate that online? So that's really this idea of a virtual commerce. And but what we're also seeing from the virtual space is how to truly engage with your customers more. For example, I had a company come and talk to my students in North Carolina about going into retail stores and creating a virtual walkthrough. So very similar to what real estate agents are doing now, when you walk into a house that's for sale by doing a virtual, you know, scan of the environment and then digitizing that in a way that allows a customer who, let's say, is in New York and is contemplating moving to North Carolina to actually walk through that environment. So we're seeing that trend in real estate agencies. We're seeing that trend in retail stores as well. So what his business does is goes into retail locations, sets up 8 360-degree cameras that take static pictures, and then he merges those together and puts that content onto the retail store's website. So it allows customers to walk through as if they are walking through the retail environment. And then the other aspect of this technology is in some up-and-coming businesses that we're working with in my classes on virtual reality footwear. So interestingly, about 30% of all people who use virtual reality headsets actually experience vertigo, or they get, I guess, car sick from that perspective. And I'm one of those people. And it turns out that 30% of those people, it's because they don't feel grounded physically and they don't see their feet. And so this particular startup, which has won a couple of awards in North Carolina just recently, has got a patent on virtual reality footwear. And so we're working with them to try to explore how to value their company, what uses it has, and everything from not just games, which is how it started. So, you know, can I sit on my in my lovely recliner and, you know, use my feet to operate my avatar in a virtual game, but also lots of other applications in medical and other types of service-related industries, athletics, things like that. And so it really is, you know, I wrote a paper on virtual commerce back in 2010, mostly because the school I was teaching at in France had a very active Second Life presence, and there were tons of brands that were actually present in the professional side of Second Life. And I was really intrigued by that. And so I wrote an entry to an encyclopedia on virtual commerce. But we weren't really using it because we didn't have the technology to put that in the hands of consumers, much less in the hands of business owners. And so basically over the last 7 years, what's happened is technology has caught up with a lot of those initial ideas, and the applications now for virtual reality, augmented reality, virtual commerce are now much greater than they were, you know, in the past. And the reason that I try to travel so much is because you know, the U.S. population is only 5% of the global population. And so when I'm talking to businesses, you know, we're not just talking about, you know, the domestic market. That a lot of these concepts that I like to talk to them about are really worldwide. And so we have to understand how customers are using digital technology, how they're using cell phone technology and internet technology and so on, you know, in these other places. So so even a country like Cuba can, that kind of emerges out of a developing country, they have leapfrogged a lot of the technology progressions that we experienced. And as they open up more, that will change how open they are to technology. Some countries that we would consider, you know, developing or even maybe marginal third world countries, they use mobile technology more than we do because that's their only source. They don't have wired, you know, internet or Ethernet access. People don't have laptops and desktop computers, but they have a phone. And so when we think about marketing strategies, you know, an SMS texting campaign can be done worldwide and quite easy to do worldwide now. And as that technology improves and people have more access to reliable wireless internet, and that will allow virtual reality and augmented reality marketing strategies to really increase around the world, not just here.
What are some of the motivations behind an individual wanting to make a virtual purchase and own something that can't be classified as possibly tangible or intangible?
So I think that when we are looking at consumer motivations, especially in a virtual space, I think you have to look at the consumer quite a bit more in depth. So I'm a working mom. I'm in a blended family, so there's six of us in this house. I work a lot. I have a consulting company. I like to say that, you know, consulting and entrepreneurship are my hobbies, just like my husband likes to run and surf. I like to listen to podcasts and learn about different companies and business practices around the world. So it's my hobby. But what that means is that I don't really have time for what might be traditional mom behaviors. And so I rely on the internet to make my life easier. And so everything from having a family calendar where everybody kind of puts in what they're doing and when they're doing it so that if I'm somewhere else, I know who's eating dinner tonight, and you know, I can get things started. So I want the Internet of Things in my life to make my life easier. So one of the things I've been telling my husband is slowly but surely we need to replace all of our even our appliances with smart appliances. I want to know, you know, I want to have smart shelving in my home pantry so I know when the bread is empty or when the peanut butter is empty, and I could literally just put in a request for more product. And so I need virtual technology to make my life easier. And so same thing applies even from a shopping perspective. I would use virtual technology if it didn't make me seasick because I don't have time to go to a brick and mortar store, you know, between the hours of, you know, 10 a.m. and 8 or 9 p.m. at night. So sometimes I'm shopping when everybody else is asleep and when I finally have some downtime and the kids are asleep. So that, you know, understanding your target consumer and what makes their life easier and what solutions you are helping them, you know, satisfy their problems or their needs, that is a marketing principle that is timeless. It's just utilizing technology to create those solutions. And so I'm fascinated by companies that can solve problems that working parents in this particular case have always had with unique solutions. So everything from retail boxes, so subscription-based services, something that I didn't think I would ever do, but I'm now part of the Hubble contact lens subscription service because I just did not have time to get to an eye doctor every time I needed to refresh or repurchase my contact lenses. And so from the medical space or the health space, I just didn't have the time to do it. And Hubble came around and has this great subscription service. And you know, I pay $30 a month and I get my daily contact lenses shipped to me monthly and I don't have to think about it anymore. And so I want that kind of convenience. Granted, I'm a digital, I'm a digital Gen Xer and I love that technology can enhance my life. And but I think there are a lot of families like me. So understanding your customer and what kinds of technology solutions can make their life easier is really the key to really capitalizing on these virtual and augmented and mobile trends.
I think you might have answered my next question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So what advice, now this is going to Suzanne, the practitioner, what advice would you give to a business operator that is starting to use behavioral insights but doesn't really understand much of behavioral insight?
Well, I think that the key thing for a company is to understand their data that they have already at their fingertips about their customers. I think what's happened in the last 10 years as we've moved to this digital space is that we went from a scenario where we didn't have a lot of data about our customers to a situation where we have too much data about our customers. And so a lot of small businesses that I work with in my classes, because I like to do project-based coursework in my classes, so I bring companies in and I have my students basically act like mini consultants and solve or help a company, small company, solve some of their marketing issues or challenges, is that companies are afraid of the data. And so what happens is that they might rely on what I would call more univariate data, like in a dashboard that you might get on Google Analytics or that you might get by looking at your social media analytics or insight pages. And what's happening is there is a distinct lack of connecting those dots between the digital analytics and the actual business outcomes. So having a return on your marketing investment, knowing what promotional activities or promotional communications result in the best outcomes for your company are really important, but companies don't know how to do that. So I'm sort of on this mission lately to be increasing statistical literacy, or what I call storytelling with data, in my students. Because that is really the important skill that I feel I can teach them, is how to take data analytics and convert it into a story that a company, that an entrepreneur, that a business can understand, so that they're no longer afraid of the data, but they're using the data constructively to design strategy. And that's really what my passion is in telling good stories, but using the data to tell the story.
So what is next for you? What's next on Suzanne's plate?
I don't know. This is the summer of potentially a pivot. I think I've been doing a lot of thinking about my goals. As I see them, or as I laid out my life, ultimately, I think I would love to be a dean or a university president someday. But I think I'd like to pivot out of academics for a while. I've been getting a lot of more C-level opportunities, whether that's in a very fascinating area called fractional chief marketing officer positions, or obviously some sweat equity in some startup firms and entrepreneurs that I've been working with for a few years. And so I think I'll always keep a foot in the door in academics because I love to teach. And but I think that my teaching has really become more in teaching adults, teaching business owners, in kind of bringing back that sort of educational focus to physicians and lawyers and entrepreneurs who have either never had courses in business or they now have a different perspective as business owners of what the importance of those business concepts. So, you know, I think I'd still always, you know, teach in Finland or, you know, teach at my alma mater at Notre Dame or teach online perhaps, you know, in the UNC system. But I'm looking at other opportunities and I'm curious about them and I'm excited about them. And I think that as businesses, as we transition to more of a service economy and a more remote virtual, you know, the ability to do your job from anywhere is that's very appealing to me. And I think if that kind of structure was in place 20 years ago when I left college, you know, I think I would have adopted some of those opportunities right away. As a working mom, you know, a virtual or remote type of consulting work is very amenable to my lifestyle, but it also allows me to pursue some of those curious questions that I have that I really want to put into play. And so a company that will allow me to play with the data or to play with the promotional campaigns to try to combine this behavioral science insight that we have from our journals and our academician research, but then actually applying it in the real world is what I'm looking at in the next 5 to 10 years of my life.
Suzanne, it's always an absolute pleasure to have you on ClickSuasion. You always have an interesting insight to entrepreneurship, marketing, data analysis, etc. If any listeners want to get in contact with you, how could they reach you?
Thanks. If they want to get in touch with me, I'm at altabello.research@gmail.com. And I have a couple of different you know, identities online, depending on what type of consumer research I'm doing. But ultimately, that's the best way to get in touch with me. And of course, I'm on Twitter and on LinkedIn. And as I like to say, you know, my name is quite Italian. It means tall and beautiful in Italian. And my dad said I got none of the first and all of the last, as dads are supposed to do. But it's Alto Bello. altobello.research@gmail.com.
Suzanne, thank you so much for being here. It's been, an absolute pleasure. Always is.
Thanks so much, Michael. I wish you great success with ClickSuasion. It's now on my podcast list.
That's what I want to hear. Outstanding. Thanks for listening to ClickSuasion. This is Michael Barbera. We've been here with Susan Altobello. Go ahead and subscribe to ClickSuasion on iTunes, Google Play, or go to ClickSuasion.com, and we'll let you know when the next episode is available.
Thanks for listening to ClickSuasion. Subscribe to the podcast, read our research, and get in touch with us at ClickSuasion.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @ClickSuasion.